What does it mean to be made to vanish while you're still alive? Not metaphorically, but on paper, in the categories that decide who gets counted, funded, protected. I think about this every time I fill out these forms. Do I lie and check white so the machine runs smoothly? Or do I write in Arab or Palestinian or whatever in the margins and watch it not even matter? That tiny moment is a keyhole into a whole system built to make us disappear, not in theory, but in blood, in budgets, in life itself. This is Palestine Exists. Welcome back. It's just me again today, Habuba. Petra's gonna be out for a few weeks recovering from surgery. She's okay, alhamdulillah. She just needs time to heal. Send her some love if you can. So, let's talk about the violence you don't always see coming. The kind buried in forms and databases and the shit that looks harmless until you realize it's deciding whether we live or not. I know some of you might think I'm being dramatic, and some people might hear this and think it's just a form. Who cares? But that's exactly the point. The most effective violence doesn't look like violence. It looks like policy. It looks neutral. And this isn't about feeling seen or representation or whatever liberal framework you want to put on it. It's about what happens when the system erases you from the data and you die because of it. When you're not in the data, you're not in the budget. And when you're not in the budget, you're not in the services. And when you're not in the services, you die. It's that simple. We're going to walk through how disappearance is engineered through race law, through data architecture, through surveillance, through budgets that pretend that we're fine. And yeah, I know, they finally added a MENA category for 2030 census. Great. Slow clap. But that's after decades of erasing us. It'll take years to implement. How many of us will die in the meantime? How many already have? This isn't about a nice new checkbox. It's about how whiteness gets weaponized to erase us, how Palestinians in diaspora get erased twice, once by policy and once by fear. Let's get into it. So, we're white now, right? I mean, like, that's what the official forms say, healthcare, school, jobs, whatever. There's white, black, Asian, Native, Hispanic. No Arab, no Middle Eastern, just white. As if that word has ever protected us. And I want you to know something. They've been building it this way for a long time. Nothing about it is accidental. And it's older by 9/11, like by a century. So let me take you back to 1913. Ex-part Shahid. A Syrian Muslim man applies for citizenship in South Carolina. And the judge says no, that he's not white enough. Remember, at that time, you could only naturalize if you were legally white. And he didn't just say no and move on. He wrote an entire opinion why Arabs should never count as white. And I'm not making this up, they literally used race science. They measured skull shapes, they analyzed forehead angles, they described his skin as a walnut or darker than the usual mulatto. That's a direct quote. They said Arabs, especially Muslim ones, were part of this Mohammedan world that was culturally and racially quote-unquote alien to white Christian civilization. But then, just 2 years later, in 1915, Dow v. United States is established. Suddenly, Syrians are white enough to qualify for citizenship. What changed? Not us. Whiteness just needed to be stretched enough to keep excluding the people they really wanted to keep out while letting in just enough others to maintain their system. The judge in that case literally referenced Jesus Christ, I'm not kidding, saying that since Jesus was from the same region and was obviously white, Syrians just had to be too, because obviously Jesus couldn't have been anything else, right? And then, in 1942, with Inray Hassan, a Yemeni Muslim is denied citizenship because he's part of the Mohammedan world again. But by 1944, America had just finished one world war and was right in the middle of another. And wars need two things, money and oil. When America needed Saudi oil, the timing of ex-part Mohriez was no coincidence. Aramco was being established, and suddenly, Arabs were white again. How convenient. But by the civil rights era, it gets even slicker. In 1987, St. Francis College versus Al-Khazrazi said that Arabs could claim racial discrimination, but federal data still quoted us as white. The courts sat there and nodded at our reality, and the systems that control these resources ignored it. And in practice, it's done nothing. We got the precedent, but not the protection. Wadia Al-Fayoumi was 6 years old. Six. He lived with his mom, Hanan, in an apartment outside Chicago. The day after October 7th, their landlord told Hanan, "Your people are killing babies in Israel," and tried to evict them. On October 13th, he broke into their home and stabbed Hanan in her face, her neck, her back. She fought him off, ran to the bathroom, and called 911. When she came out, she found her son, her baby, stabbed 26 times. 26 separate wounds in a six-year-old's body, while the landlord shouted, "You devil Muslim, you must die." Hanan survived. Wadia didn't. And how did the state classify this attack? Anti-Muslim bias. Not anti-Palestinian, not racist, just bias. Like it was a misunderstanding at a dinner party instead of a child being slaughtered in his own home. Or take what happened in Burlington, Vermont last November. Three Palestinian college students, Hisham Awartani, Tahsin Ali Ahmad, and Kanaan Abdul Hamid, were walking near campus, speaking Arabic, two of them wearing kufiyas. A man shot them. Hisham was left paralyzed, and to this day, it hasn't been federally designated as a hate crime. And then there's Alex O'Day, a Palestinian-American Christian, regional director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. In 1985, he opened the door to his office and was killed by a pipe bomb. Crazy is that he'd been on TV days earlier defending Palestinians. The FBI said, yeah, sure, it was a terrorist attack, and they even suspected the Jewish Defense League. But no one was ever arrested or charged, and it's been almost 40 years. Nothing. This is the pattern. Violence that's obvious to everyone except the systems that are supposed to record and prosecute it. And here's something that'll blow your mind. From 1992 to 2015, the FBI didn't even track anti-Arab hate crimes. That's 23 years, including all of post-9/11, where we didn't exist in federal hate crime records. The FBI used to have a category for it, Code 31, but they deliberately eliminated it right when hate crimes against Arabs were spiking after the first Gulf War. Everything was shoved into anti-Muslim or anti-other, because Arab or Arab identity was never specific enough to matter. Even when states reported them, they were wiped from federal numbers. Post 9/11, hate crimes against Arabs skyrocketed an estimated 1,600%. And between 2012 and 2015 alone, more than 1,900 state-reported anti-Arab hate crimes disappeared from FBI statistics. And in 2015, yeah, they finally brought the category back, but in the same week, Congress passed laws criminalizing Palestinian solidarity. It's like, you know, fine, we'll admit you're being attacked, but we're also going to criminalize your political expression. It's so backward. It's like recognition only comes paired with punishment. And somehow we still have to prove it every time, as if there's like a checklist. How brown were they? What Middle Eastern country? Were they associated with any groups? Were they visibly Arab? Were they praying five times a day? Did they pray outside? Were they wearing a kufiya, or were they just quietly existing? And in 2023 alone, CARE logged over 8,000 complaints, the highest in their history. The ADC recorded 2,500 anti-Arab incidents between October of 2023 and March of 2024, a 400% increase. And the FBI, they reported 123 incidents. 123. Wadia was six. Hisham was walking home. Alex was unlocking his office door. They were Palestinian, and that's all it took. Just existing makes us suspects. And even after we're killed, even when the bodies are still warm, we get told it's complicated. As if the same police who surveil us, deported us, and locked us up in Guantanamo Bay are suddenly going to protect us? Please. And that's why the cases go cold, why nothing moves, because we were never written in as people who mattered in the first place. And like, what do we get? A statement? A funeral? Maybe a hashtag. But always, always paired with a warning not to make it political. And they won't protect us, but they'll watch us. That's the trade-off, the bait and switch. When we're attacked, the state shrugs, and when we speak, it listens too closely. We don't get safety, we get surveillance. And this didn't start after 9/11 either. It also goes back decades. In 1972, Nixon rolled out Operation Boulder, 13 federal agencies targeting over 150,000 Arabs and Arab Americans, supposedly to stop terrorism after the Munich Olympics. What it actually stopped was Palestinian activism, especially on campuses. The FBI coordinated with Mossad and the Anti-Defamation League to keep tabs on quote-unquote active Arabs. And after all that, not one terrorism conviction. Not one. Then came 9/11. They gave the old playbook a bigger budget. NSEERS, the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, forced men from 25 countries, 24 of them being Arab or Muslim majority, to register, be interrogated, and to check in like criminals. 138,000 people went through it. Zero convictions. But 14,000 plus deportations in a single year. Families shattered, communities gutted, and for what? Meanwhile, the NYPD's demographics unit was mapping every single part of Muslim life. Bookstores, cafes, student clubs, restaurants. Undercover officers were in classrooms and prayer spaces. They sat and recorded conversations, photographed license plates, and made informants out of students. Again, no charges. It just left a generation that learned that their jokes, their grief in their everyday lives should and could be turned into evidence against them. And now they've rebranded it as targeted violence and terrorism prevention, or behavioral threat assessments. Slap the word safety on it, and you can put it in school, in campuses, in workplaces. The infrastructure hasn't gone anywhere. It's just wearing a friendlier name. And since October 7th, they've gone fully mask off. Columbia suspending 80-plus students for Palestinian advocacy, or faculty fired just for mentioning Gaza in class. Palestine Legal received 2,000 requests for help in the first half of 2024, which was up 600% since 2022. Google firing 50-plus workers for protesting its contract with Israel. Law firms pulling offers from Georgetown and NYU grads for supporting Palestine. And here's where it gets truly dystopian. In federal court last month, an ICE agent testified under oath that they had a special team called the Tiger Team, their words, whose entire job was to target and deport pro-Palestinian student activists. And can y'all guess where they got their intel from? Canary Mission, a literal blacklist doxing site that exists to harass and destroy the careers of people who speak for Palestine. ICE reviewed nearly 5,000 Canary Mission profiles looking for people to go after. So yes, the US government is now officially using a Zionist smear site as a source for immigration enforcement. That's where we are. Surveillance isn't just about what they collect. It's about what you stop saying, what you don't post, what you don't admit, even to your own people. It closes in on you without you even realizing, and it shrinks your life until you stop showing up altogether. And here's the kicker. The surveillance tech built to target Arabs didn't stay in our communities. They became the blueprint for broader control. The facial recognition tested at checkpoints in Palestine gets deployed in schools all across America, and the social media monitoring developed to track Palestinian extremism now scans Black Lives Matter hashtags, and the predictive policing that maps Arab threat networks now targets Latino neighborhoods for ICE raids. It's not parallel oppression or we also get police. No, it's the same system perfecting itself through repetition. And all of this, it's still happening while Gaza is being annihilated in front of the world, while thousands of children are being bombed, starved, and buried. And we're being profiled just for saying their names. They can't protect our families, but they can flag our passports. And they can't stop settlers from killing us, but they will absolutely fire us for mourning our dead. And here's the thing about that little blue passport. If you're Palestinian, it doesn't mean what they tell you it means. It won't stop an Israeli bullet. It won't get you justice. And half the time it won't even give you a phone call back from the embassy. Because when it's a Palestinian American murdered, the State Department goes quiet. When a Palestinian American journalist is executed in broad daylight, on camera, they shrug. When an 80-year-old Palestinian American is beat and left to die at a checkpoint, the best they can do is express concern. This is flesh and blood. These are our people. Let me tell you about Shirin Abu Akleh. She wasn't just a journalist. She was the voice of Palestine for a generation. Everyone remembers growing up and watching her. Born in Jerusalem, a Christian American citizen, a veteran Al Jazeera reporter for 25 years. On May 11th of 2022, she was standing with other journalists in Jenin wearing a blue press vest, a helmet that was clearly marked, nowhere near any clashes, when an Israeli sniper fires a single shot right into the space between her helmet and her vest, through her skull, in broad daylight, with witnesses all around. Multiple investigations by CNN, The Washington Post, New York Times, the UN, all concluded the same thing. Israeli forces deliberately shot her. And the United States' response? They asked Israel to review its policies. They said the killing was probably by Israeli forces, but it was unintentional. Unintentional? A precision shot to the only exposed part of her head from a trained sniper with a rifle that doesn't fire randomly? What kind of accident looks like that? And again, no sanctions, no consequences, no justice, just a press release. And even in death, they didn't let her rest. At her funeral in Jerusalem, Israeli police beat mourners and attacked the pallbearers until they nearly dropped her coffin. Her gravestone has been vandalized and destroyed more than once. What about 80-year-old Omar Asad, a Palestinian-American from Wisconsin? In January of 2022, he was driving home in the West Bank when Israeli soldiers stopped him at a checkpoint. They dragged this 80-year-old man from his car, blindfolded him, zip-tied him, beat him, and then they just left him there, on the cold ground, in the middle of winter, face down. Had a heart attack and died right there in the dirt. Or what about Tawfiq Ajak, a 17-year-old kid from Louisiana, killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank in January of 2024. He was shot in the head while driving with his friends. No stones, no protest, no threat. Just a kid in a car. The bullet entered through the back window. He wasn't even facing them. And the U.S. response? We're looking into it. And it's not just those three. It's Mohammed Khadour, a 17-year-old from Florida, shot in the head by Israeli forces while driving in Bidu in February of 2024. It's Kamal Jawad, an elderly man from Chicago, beaten by Israeli soldiers. It's Amir Rabi, shot in the head. It's Abdul Rahman Barbar, shot in the chest. It's Saifullah Sif Musalat, 20 years old, from Tampa, beaten to death by settlers in July of 2025 while visiting his family's farm near Ramallah. Paramedics were blocked from reaching him for 3 hours. He bled out alone. It's Muhammad Zahir Ibrahim, a 16-year-old taken from his home in Silwad in February of 2024. Blindfolded, handcuffed, and dumped in Megiddo prison. He and his family are from Florida. The kid lost 12 kilos. He caught scabies, and he's still awaiting trial for rock throwing. No conviction, no release. And these are just the ones that we know. There are more. There are always more. The truth is, American citizenship is conditional. It's awaited. And if you're Palestinian, it's paper thin. It doesn't protect you from Israeli bullets. It won't stop a settler's fists. It damn sure doesn't even guarantee justice. It barely even acknowledges it. It connects back to everything else we've been talking about. Misclassification, data erasure, budgets. On paper, we're white. In reality, we're disposable. There is no category for what's happening to us. No official record of anti-Palestinian violence by a U.S. ally. Meanwhile, Israeli Americans get full protection. They can serve in the IDF, kill Palestinians and Americans, and still be shielded by the U.S. government. We say Free Palestine one too many times and we're the ones under investigation. So when people ask why racial classification matters or why recognition matters, this is why. Because without it, there's no pattern, no name, no justice. There's just a string of isolated incidents. The state pretends that it doesn't connect. Things that happen sometimes to someone somewhere. And let's say you survive. You make it through the profiling, the surveillance, the hate crimes. You keep your head down. You censor yourself online. You avoid the wrong rooms. And somehow, you're still here. But then something happens. Your father's blood pressure spikes. Your cousin overdoses. And your sister dies giving birth. And suddenly, you're in a hospital, begging someone to take you seriously. In the same system that flagged you at TSA, that tracked your mosque attendance, now looks at you like you're a stranger. Because on paper, you're white. And whiteness in this country is the baseline. The category they assume is doing fine. But we're not fine. And the data doesn't care. It absorbs our deaths into the average and tells a story that isn't ours. Arab women are dying in childbirth, hemorrhaging, developing preeclampsia, being ignored when they say something's wrong. The only reason we even know the numbers is because Arab community organizations in Michigan paid for their own studies because the federal government wouldn't touch it. Those studies found not only that, but that Arab Americans have higher rates of depression, higher diabetes rates, higher adolescent mental health struggles, and no targeted resources to match. The COVID-19 pandemic exposed how classification as white literally killed us. Arab Americans tested positive at 17%, more than twice the rate of non-Hispanic white people. These disparities feed into a $451 billion annual burden from health inequities in this country, and we don't get a cent. That white label shuts us out of billions in minority health funding. It blocks Arab-serving universities from qualifying as minority-serving institutions. It's not just a box. It's a wall built around entire funding streams. The Department of Health and Human Services runs over $1.7 trillion in health programs every year. The NIH spends $281 million annually on minority health research. SAMHSA distributes millions for culturally specific mental health and addiction services. None of it is earmarked for Arab Americans because officially, we don't exist, so we build them ourselves. Clinics, doulas, overdose response teams, research projects, and somehow that becomes proof that we don't need help. Local Arab community centers provide services that should be funded by DHHS, by SAMHSA, by the CDC. And it's not sustainable to expect communities to fund their own survival while paying taxes into a system that erases them. And the worst part? When we succeed, despite these barriers, our success gets used against us. Look, Arab Americans are doing fine. They're opening businesses, going to college, they're building community centers. They don't need special programs or targeted funding. This is how erasure becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Erase a group from your data, deny them resources based on that erasure, and then point to their struggles as individual failures rather than systemic exclusion. Or rather, point to their successes as evidence that the system works fine, ignoring the immense community resources it took to achieve those successes without support. And if they can erase your death, they can control your life. If they can control your life, they'll decide how and if you create it. Arab and Palestinian women's bodies become another border to manage. Hospitals don't always meet Arab women as patients. They usually meet us as problems. When an Arab woman says that she's in pain, she's less likely to be believed. When she explains her symptoms, she's more likely to be dismissed. And when she needs intervention, she's more likely to be delayed. IVF and fertility care are designed without us in mind, and language access is patchy at best or non-existent at worst. If you're visibly Muslim, the bias doubles. Postpartum depression? Real. Resources, though, rare. And none of it shows up cleanly in the data because the category is wrong. And it's not separate from what happens in Palestine. The same Israeli politicians who call Palestinian birth rates demographic threats, like Netanyahu when he called Palestinian citizens of Israel a demographic time bomb, or when Ben-Gvir refers to Palestinian fertility as an existential danger to Jews, it's the same mentality that leads to forced sterilization of Ethiopian Jewish women in Israel. And in Palestine, it's about controlling who gets to reproduce at all. In the U.S., it shows up as missing maternal health programs or misdiagnoses and silence in the statistics. Different ends, same question. Whose children are valued and whose bodies are policed? Arab women in Michigan face higher rates of gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, and pregnancy complications than white women. They're less likely to receive adequate prenatal care, less likely to have culturally competent providers, and less likely to have access to Arabic language materials about pregnancy and childbirth. And think about it. Me, personally, every single Arab woman I know has either almost died giving birth or their child has died giving birth. Now ask other Arab women around you and see if they've had similar experiences, but none of it is counted. There's no pattern to take note of that. And when these complications arise, the white label turns us into statistical outliers instead of a documented pattern that deserves intervention. Reproductive justice isn't just about the right not to have children. It's also about the right to have children and raise them in safe conditions. For Arab and Palestinian women here, that means almost dying in childbirth, only to bury your baby 15 years later because Narcan wasn't available for the nearest 50 miles. The border isn't just at an airport or a checkpoint. It's in the hospital room. It's the insurance policy. It's in the code that decides whether your community gets prenatal health grants or not. And we're visible when we're useful. For a diversity flyer, for a grant proposal, a panel that wants to, you know, quote-unquote balance. But as long as we keep it light, you know, talk about food, our culture, maybe recite some poetry, we're welcome. But the second we bring up Palestine, we're a problem. And I've seen this play out so many times. Arab academics get tenure as long as they avoid Palestine in their research. Or Arab artists get funding as long as their work is universal. Arab organizers get invited to coalitions as long as they focus on safer issues. But when we insist on being whole, Arab, Palestinian, political, the doors close. You can be a minority in this country and still protect the same systems that erase other people if it keeps your seat at the table. And that includes other minorities too. Let's not pretend it doesn't. Because I'm not interested in playing trauma Olympics, but I'm also not interested in pretending that being marginalized in the US makes you incapable of reproducing the violence of empire. We've been betrayed by other oppressed people, loudly, repeatedly, and with full knowledge of what it means. You think Palestinians don't notice when black and brown celebrities parrot Zionist talking points? When they post themselves drinking Starbucks and eating McDonald's? Or when indigenous organizers refuse to say Free Palestine because they don't want to complicate their message? Or when Asian American politicians vote to send more bombs into Gaza? You think that we don't see it? They act like it's not their issue, like we're dragging them into something too messy, as if there's anything clean about genocide, as if their silence isn't bought. Some Latino and Asian American advocacy spaces lobbied against adding MENA to the census categories. Why? Because they feared that they would lose their own funding. We've been hurt by white people, yes, but not only. That's the trap. Offering conditional inclusion, saying, sure, you can have a seat at the table, but only if you leave half of yourself at the door. It's an offer that rewards distance from Palestine and punishes connection to it. And listen, I get it. Americanness is seductive. Belonging is addictive. And the promise of belonging is powerful, especially for immigrants, for refugees, for the marginalized. And when you've never been safe, crumbs of recognition can feel like a meal. I understand that temptation. But Palestine forces the choice, principle or proximity. You can get close to power or you can keep your principles, but rarely both. And too many choose proximity. Too many decide that partial inclusion is better than complete exclusion. They won't say Free Palestine, but they'll post a Palestinian recipe and call it Middle Eastern. They won't call it a genocide. But, you know, they'll wear kufiya when it's trendy. They want to mourn us in theory and not in practice. And this is what makes it worse. We've been erased institutionally and abandoned relationally by the system and by the people who we're supposed to understand. People who know what it's like to be surveilled. People who know what it's like to be erased. And still, they look away. Or worse, they participate. Because the system rewards them for it. And that's what nobody wants to say out loud. They benefit from our erasure. They gain access. They gain legitimacy. They get to keep their jobs, their platforms, and their illusion of being the good minorities. And we get profiled, investigated, fired, flagged, exiled. But there are exceptions. People who refuse that bargain. People who will risk their own position to stand in solidarity, no matter the cost. Chris Smalls is one of them. He didn't just organize Amazon workers. He stood on the deck of the Handala, of the flotilla, sailing towards Gaza to break the siege. He put his body in the path of an apartheid regime's blockade, knowing exactly what it could mean for his safety, his freedom, and his career. And that's real solidarity, the kind that's not conditional, the kind that doesn't disappear when the consequences get real. This country never wanted to include us. It wanted to manage us. And that when that didn't work, it outsourced the management to other safe brown bodies who knew the rules. So yeah, I'm angry. Not just the state, but at the people who pretended that we were part of something bigger, who called us sibling struggles while refusing to say our names, who want to be intersectional until they hit the Gaza checkpoint and turn back. We're not your symbol. We're not your shadow reference. We're not your exception clause. We are real and we are mourning. We are targeted and we will not fucking shrink ourselves to make you comfortable. If your solidarity has a disclaimer, we don't want it. And if your empathy stops at the border, then keep it. And if your identity as an oppressed person in America requires our silence to function, then it's not liberation you're after, it's clout. We were never included. We were tolerated at best. And now we're being erased in high definition. And most of you are still too scared to name it. Not because you don't know, but because you do. And you'd rather stay safe. Let's start from the truth. Being a minority in this country doesn't absolve you of perpetuating racism. It doesn't make you incapable of violence, and it sure as hell doesn't mean you understand what Palestinians are going through. Hate crimes against every other group dropped after 9/11. Ours skyrocketed. Why? Because everyone knew the assignment. The country wanted a new villain, and they handed us over without blinking. That's the thing about American racial logic. It doesn't just silence us from the top. It gets internalized. It gets echoed. It gets weaponized laterally. And now we're left stuck in the middle. Not white enough to be protected, not minority enough to be mourned. We exist in this fucked up in-between, where other marginalized groups are allowed grief, allowed visibility, allowed outrage, but we're not. Because grieving our dead is political. Because our pain is threatening. Because our visibility makes the whole system uncomfortable, even to people who know what it's like to be oppressed. I don't judge the individuals who make these choices. The system is designed to force these impossible trade-offs. But I do judge the system itself, and I question any form of inclusion that requires us to fragment ourselves to be accepted. So what now? OMB added a MENA category? Great. But if it stays on paper, nothing changes. Implementation to this is the fight. That means every form, every database, every record, health, school, police, death certificates gets updated. And there should be public timelines so we know when it's happening. It means going back through older data sets, using the tools that we have now to see the patterns they've been ignoring for decades. It means officers get trained to actually recognize and code anti-Arab hate crimes. And departments keep reporting zeros should get audited. It means campuses can't use private blacklists like Canary Mission to punish students. And it means our health systems get the resources they've denied us. Maternal care, mental health access in Arabic, overdose prevention. And this isn't special treatment. It's basic governance. Being counted is the floor, not the ceiling. The 2024 MENA fix matters. But it only matters if we force it into every data set, every system, every agency that governs our lives. Go ask your school district, your hospital, your police department when the change goes live. Ask your city why anti-Arab isn't a code. And when the spreadsheet looks clean, ask who got erased to make it that way. Because this fight isn't just about Arabs or Palestinians. The same architecture that erases us erases Black women whose maternal deaths go uncounted. It erases Indigenous communities whose health crises get ignored. The border doesn't run through Palestine. It runs through every community fighting to exist against erasure. And while we push here, we're watching that same erasure in its most brutal form back home, not in spreadsheets, but in streets, in homes, and in bodies. That same architecture that erases us from the data here erases our people from life itself there. That's why we end every episode with a name. One life that carries the weight of the whole. This is Humanize Gaza, where we remember one martyr's life in detail because every number in this genocide is a person with a story. Please subscribe to the newsletter at humanizegaza.org. Name one life, hold the whole. Today, remember Khamis Ayad, 40 years old, a Palestinian-American father of five from Chicago who was killed in Silwad, West Bank, on July 31st, 2025, last week. Khamis was visiting family in his hometown when Israeli settlers arrived before dawn, setting fire to cars outside his family home. When Khamis woke up and saw his car burning, he rushed outside to put out the flames. That's when Israeli soldiers appeared, and instead of stopping the settlers, they fired tear gas in his direction. Khamis died there, in front of his home, from the combination of tear gas and smoke inhalation, choking to death while trying to protect what was rightfully his. His family has demanded a full investigation from the Department of Justice. An American citizen was killed, and his family's been asking, but where's the accountability? But like so many Palestinian Americans before him, Khamis's American passport didn't protect him. His five children now grow up without their father, and another name joins the list of those whose killers will face no consequences. Allah yirhamak Khamis, we will not forget your name. This racial purgatory, this architecture of erasure, wasn't built by accident. It was engineered to make us vanish. And vanishing isn't just symbolic. It's material. It's life and death. The box they tell us to check is connected to the bullets they refuse to stop. The data they ignore is connected to the lives that they don't value. So we fight on both fronts. For recognition in systems that govern our lives here, and for survival against those who would erase us entirely there. Because erasure is never just paperwork, it's always preparation. This is Palestine Exists. Thank you for listening. See you next week.